UTC.
I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday announced a big new military aid package for Ukraine 3 weeks before leaving office. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says the U.S. will send nearly $2.5 billion more in weapons to Kyiv. It comes as his administration has vowed to spend all it has available to help Ukraine before Donald Trump takes over. The administration wants Ukraine in the strongest negotiating position possible, with Trump talking about working on some type of deal between Kyiv and Moscow. The Treasury Department says the U.S. will also send some $3.4 billion in economic aid to pay for things like salaries of teachers and first responders. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Ukraine's president says Russia and Ukraine conducted a prisoner swap on Monday that was mediated by the United Arab Emirates and other partners. Reuters correspondent Arthi Dyaprin has more.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said 189 POWs were brought home, including soldiers, sergeants, and officers from different frontline areas. He said it also included two Ukrainian civilians who were captured by Russian troops at the southern port of Mariupol in 2022. Zelensky also thanked the United Arab Emirates and other partners for facilitating the swap. Meanwhile, Russian soldiers were seen getting on a bus and speaking with Russia's Human Rights Commissioner, Tatiana Moskalkova, in a video posted on her Telegram channel. The Russian Defense Ministry said 150 Russian servicemen were returning home. Moscow added that Russian captives had been released on Belarusian territory and would be transferred to Russia.
Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin. This is VOA News. South Korean officials plan to conduct safety inspections of all Boeing 737-800 aircraft operated by the country's airlines as they struggle to determine what caused Sunday's plane crash of a Boeing 737-800 that killed 179 people. Acting President Choi Sang-mok also instructed authorities on Monday to conduct an emergency review of the country's aircraft operation systems. The plane, operated by South Korean budget airline Jeju Air, skidded off a runway at Muan International Airport, slammed into a concrete fence, and burst into a fireball. All but two of the 181 people aboard were killed. Earth is getting more crowded, although the rate of growth was a little slower in 2024 than it was in 2023. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Census Bureau estimates find the world population by New Year's Day will be 8.09 billion people. That's an increase of 71 million people this year alone. In the U.S., there were 2.6 million more people, bringing the population to 341 million. The Census Bureau says this coming year in America, the combination of a birth every 9 seconds, a death every 9.4 seconds, and population growth from migration will result in one new person being added every 21 seconds. I'm Jackie Quinn.
New York police say security will be extra tight ahead of celebrations on the last night of the year. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Bomb-sniffing dogs, drones, dump trucks blocking streets, and cops on every corner. That's just some of the NYPD security for New Year's Eve in Times Square.
At this time, there are no specific credible threats.
However, Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch says ever since last year's Hamas attack in Israel, they've been operating in a heightened threat environment.
The public can expect to see a tremendous amount of police resources deployed throughout the area and across the city.
Mayor Eric Adams says it's all about making sure everyone has a safe experience.
There are many officers that have plainclothes assignments to give the element of surprise.
Thousands are expected to pack the small area of Times Square surrounding the ball drop, even more in the buildings and blocks surrounding it. Julie Walker, New York.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, VOANews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Carter remembered. I came to know a punctual man more interested in concrete results than the optics or politics surrounding them. A supremely humble and patient citizen of the world who made time for everyone who sought him out.
The politics of guns in America.
Pew Research surveys show there's broad bipartisan support among the public for preventing people with mental illness from purchasing guns. But Americans remain deeply divided on most gun policy proposals.
And a program in Pakistan helps women gain independence by teaching them a new skill.
A group of Pakistani women listen intently as an instructor gathers them around a motorcycle.
Today is Tuesday, December 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Following his death at age 100 on Sunday, the U.S. and the world have been learning more about the remarkable life of Jimmy Carter, Navy lieutenant, state governor, the 39th president, Nobel Prize winner, and on and on. For 17 years, VOA correspondent Kane Farbaugh has covered the life and legacy of Jimmy Carter, developing a close friendship with him along the way. Here, now, he shares his personal reflections about the late world leader and influential humanitarian.
So start on that camera.
When we first met in 2006, during one of his book tours, I had not yet interviewed a former president. I was nervous. Jimmy Carter, on the other hand.
It's also not the first time you've probably done this.
No, it's not the first time.
Over the course of nearly two decades and dozens of one-on-one interviews, Carter became more than just the subject of my news reports. He became a friend to me and my family, and even spent time with my children, including my eldest son, Lucas.
I want to shake hands with you. Your father's one of my best friends. You like him too? Is he a good father or not?
My desire to better understand the 39th president's life and legacy brought me to events and symposiums around the country organized by the Carter Center, his global nonprofit organization. I came to know a punctual man more interested in concrete results than the optics or politics surrounding them. A supremely humble and patient citizen of the world who made time for everyone who sought him out.
All right, everybody look this way. Good.
I also collected and read books, those he wrote and those written about him. And I often visited Plains, Georgia, to see him teach Sunday school.
Since we are given this free gift of God, we should be what? Joyful and happy and thankful, right?
And participated in events hosted in his hometown.
When I teach, Plains prospers.
Initially, I didn't know anyone in Plains except the former president and his wife, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. But I was welcomed like a neighbor by those close to him. And through the years, forged friendships that endure today.
Oh, dear King! You see what my family was like, aren't you? Aren't you all amazed that I became president?
My friendship with Carter led to hosting panel discussions and participating in town hall meetings, personal dinners, fishing trips, and book signings across the country.
I saw the clip about releasing the sea turtles. That must have been exciting, right?
For our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.
But it was during our semi-regular exclusive interviews that covered everything from neglected tropical diseases to Mideast peace.
Leaving the White House seems to have been the best thing that could have happened to you, really.
I didn't think so at the time, but it's turned out to be.
That I came to understand what was important to Carter and why.
You bring a voice and awareness to people that otherwise wouldn't have a voice in the
international community. That's an important part of the Carter Center is to bring some publicity to the plight of people that may otherwise be ignored.
Some might think my friendship with Carter would prevent me from reporting on him objectively. However, I did not avoid difficult or controversial topics with him.
Their contention is that just by the fact that you visit with Hamas provides legitimacy to the way that they behave and they act.
You know, first of all, my visit didn't legitimize or delegitimize anybody.
Our friendship also didn't prevent me from covering Carter's difficult moments, such as his 2015 announcement he was dealing with life-threatening cancer.
President Carter, Kane Farbaugh with Voice of America.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, what has been the most difficult part about the news for you?
The liver surgery was fairly extensive. They removed about one-tenth of my liver, I understand.
President Carter survived his battle with cancer, but suffered further health setbacks. Despite falling and fracturing his hip in 2019, Carter did not cancel our interview ahead of his 95th birthday.
Hi, Dave.
Good morning, President Carter. How are you?
I'm fine.
It's so good to see you. Well, not as good as you.
In 2011, President Carter's son, Jeff, wrote a book documenting the ancestry of his parents. While reading it, I discovered I had an even stronger connection to President Carter. We are related through my 11th great-grandparents, some of the early settlers of Rhode Island, and Jimmy Carter was my 9th cousin, 3 times removed. But beyond an ancestral connection, while he is remembered as a peanut farmer, submariner, governor, artist, fisherman, Nobel Peace Prize recipient, carpenter, global humanitarian, and
he's often referred to as the greatest ex-president.
Yeah, and I don't like that. He was a great president. People are finding it out.
Jimmy Carter will always be, to me, the greatest man I have ever met and will ever have the good fortune to call my friend.
Thanks for giving us so much time. And
it's a pleasure.
It's always great to talk to you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. We always welcome the chance to talk to you, President Carter.
I always like to be with you. You have some very good questions, and I enjoy being with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us at the Voice of America.
It's always good to be with you.
It's always good to be with you, too, President Carter.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Our other top story today takes us to South Korea. That's where officials said on Monday they'll conduct safety inspections of all Boeing 737-800 aircraft operated by the country's airlines as they struggle to determine what caused a plane crash that killed 179 people on Sunday. Sunday's crash, the country's worst aviation disaster in decades, triggered an outpouring of national sympathy. Many people worry how effectively the South Korean government will handle the disaster as it grapples with a leadership vacuum following the recent successive impeachments of President Yoon Suk-yeol and Prime Minister Han Duck-soo, the country's two top officials. While the cause of the crash is still under investigation, we do know that just a few minutes before touching down, the pilot declared an emergency, saying there had been a bird strike. It's clear to see in the video of the incident that the plane's landing gear had not deployed. It's unclear, though, if they were damaged by the apparent bird strike or if the pilot even knew they were not functioning. Sunday's plane crash is also affecting the business world, particularly Boeing, the plane's manufacturer, who was already having a tough year, and Jeju Airlines also saw a loss in its stock price. Reuters' Alex Cohen has that part of the story.
Shares of Boeing fell as much as 6% Monday morning after Sunday's crash involving one of its 737 planes operated by Jeju Air in South Korea, which led to the deaths of 179 people. The country's transport ministry announced plans to conduct a special inspection of all 101 of those models used by South Korean airliners. One analyst told Reuters while the cause of the crash remains under investigation, it brings more reputational damage for Boeing in what has been a dismal year for the company. The stock has lost about one-third of its value this year, while the S&P 500 has risen 25%. Meanwhile, shares of Jeju Air hit their lowest level on record on Monday, trading nearly 16% lower earlier in the session before closing down about 9%.
That's Alex Cohen of Reuters reporting for us. We'll change gears now, but stay with a story centered on Asia. President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, is well known as a hardliner when it comes to U.S. relations with China. Despite being personally sanctioned by the Beijing government in 2020, Rubio says he's confident of finding a solution to engage with China if he's confirmed for the job as America's top diplomat. VOA's State Department Bureau Chief Nike Cheng reports on Rubio's legislative record and public stance on key China-related issues.
The threat that will define this century is China.
A vocal critic of China, Florida Senator Marco Rubio has proposed legislation to revitalize U.S. industrial policy and reduce dependence on imports from China. He also supports revoking the trade advantages granted to China, a position he defended as early as 2022.
We did nothing while for over two decades China methodically undermined our economic strength by stealing our critical technology, our manufacturing capacity, our jobs, We did nothing while they destroyed our social cohesion by luring away those jobs.
Now positioned to become America's next top diplomat, Rubio has advocated for empowering global partners against what he describes as China's growing economic and military aggression.
China now pursues economic imperialism, entrapping the developing world through the exploitative loans of the Belt and Road Initiative. They're now an imminent aggressor to our allies and our partners in places like Taiwan and Japan and India and elsewhere.
As a leader of the bipartisan Congressional Executive Commission on China, Rubio has supported pro-democracy movements in Hong Kong. He was later sanctioned by the Beijing government for what China said was his involvement in, quote, Hong Kong-related issues. Rubio has also pushed to bar imports tied to forced labor in Xinjiang and expand sanctions on those responsible for Uyghur human rights abuses. Nike Chin, VOA News, Washington.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Syrians and legal experts have been reacting to comments by Syria's de facto leader that new elections following the ouster of Bashar al-Assad's regime could take 4 years, drafting a new constitution up to three. In an interview with the Saudi news channel Al Arabiya, Ahmad al-Shara, formerly known as Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, stated on Sunday that holding elections in Syria requires sufficient time to lay the groundwork for a comprehensive political process. Some believe he could exploit the transition period to consolidate control over the country. In Afghanistan, the Taliban say they will close all national and foreign non-governmental groups in Afghanistan that employ women. It comes 2 years after they told NGOs to suspend the employment of Afghan women, allegedly because they didn't wear the Islamic headscarf correctly. In a letter published on X on Sunday, the economy ministry warned that failure to comply with the latest order would lead to NGOs losing their licenses to operate in Afghanistan. The United States on Monday announced nearly $2.5 billion in new military aid for Ukraine as part of a surge of assistance in the waning days of the Biden administration. The package comes 3 weeks before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Trump has questioned the level of U.S. aid for Ukraine, raising concerns among Ukrainian leaders that future U.S. support could be in jeopardy. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Coming up shortly, a look at women in Pakistan and a program there that's helping them gain independence on two wheels. But first, it's time for a look at American domestic politics. And few issues are more divisive politically in the U.S. than guns. And while gun violence prevention has been strengthened under the Biden administration, big policy changes are expected once President-elect Donald Trump returns to office in January. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias spoke with gun owners and gun safety advocates.
That gun owners' rights will be protected under his leadership is a promise that President-elect Donald Trump has said he'll swiftly deliver on.
In my second term, we will roll back every Biden attack on the Second Amendment. The attacks are fast and furious, starting the minute that Crooked Joe shuffles his way out of the White House.
Almost 47,000 lives were lost to gun violence in 2023, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. President Joe Biden put a series of measures in place that researchers say are helping to bring that number down, explains Jen Poliokonis, Director of Policy and Programming at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. She spoke via Skype.
This includes the American Rescue Plan funds to support community violence intervention programs. The Biden administration has strengthened the ability of the ATF and the FBI to regulate the industry.
Gun rights advocates say these measures violate the right to bear arms granted in the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They are confident Trump will do away with them. Alan Gottlieb is executive vice president of the Second Amendment Foundation. He spoke via Skype.
We don't think that they've done anything to keep people safe. All they've done is infringe on Second Amendment rights.
Supporters are also eager for Trump to fulfill his pledge to sign a concealed carry reciprocity law. It would facilitate permit holders traveling to all 50 states with their weapons. Nick Clark, president of the gun rights group Wisconsin Carry Incorporated, via Skype.
In each state that you pass through, you have to look up their specific gun laws, and in some cases you wouldn't be legal to carry in those particular states. So that's something that we would like to see at the federal level.
Frank Cimarelli's son, Camden, who had a history of mental health problems, died weeks after shooting himself in 2022 with a legally purchased gun. Cimarelli would like gun safety measures such as enhanced background checks to remain in place under the Trump administration.
You know, if a mom or dad wants to keep a gun in the house for protection, I have no problem with that. The problem I have is, why does your right to have a gun overshadow my right to keep a gun out of my house?
Pew Research surveys show there's broad bipartisan support among the public for preventing people with mental illness from purchasing guns. But Americans remain deeply divided on most gun policy proposals. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Turning our attention now to Africa. In 2024, protests by young Kenyans sent shockwaves through the country's political scene, forcing the government to drop proposed taxes and fire several ministers. The youth movement highlighted the challenges Kenya faces as the government tries to increase revenue from citizens who are grappling with the high cost of living and are angry about corruption and what they see as attempts to stifle dissent. As the year comes to an end, President William Ruto's government and a large section of Kenyan youth are still at odds over the direction the country is taking. Mohamed Yusuf has our story from Nairobi.
As the year comes to an end, President William Ruto's government and a large section of Kenyan youth are still at odds over the direction the country is taking. The discontent erupted in June as Parliament considered a bill that would increase taxes on certain food items and other sectors in the economy to help repay foreign loans and fund development programs. Lawmakers passed the bill, leading protesters storming the parliament buildings and burning a section of it. Ruto, seeing the public anger, declined to sign the bill into law. Nairobi has also witnessed protests against alleged police brutality. Rights groups say Kenyan security forces killed at least 65 people during protests or while in detention during 2024. On Monday, hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Nairobi to demand the release of Kenyans allegedly abducted from their homes and other places. According to human rights groups, at least 10 young critics of the government were kidnapped by unknown men in the last few weeks. The police have denied their officers were behind the abductions. Speaking in Homa Bay County on Friday, President Ruto said his government will end the mistreatment of youth. He called on parents to discipline their children. These children are a blessing that are given to us. Every parent should take care of their children. Let's work for our children. We, the government, will do our part and we will end the abductions so that the Kenyan youth can live in peace, Ruto said. Boniface Mwangi is a Kenyan activist. He says Kenyan youths are united against the political elite who have made life difficult for them.
The Gen Z movement, actually, they came together, they were united, and they had one goal to reject the finance bill, which has succeeded. And then they went a step further to demand for political reforms and change of the cabinet. And somewhat it happened, and that forced the political elite to come together. So for the first time, you have Uhuru Kenyatta, Raila Odinga, and Ruto in the same camp.
Since the protest, President Ruto has formed what he called a broad-based government. He appointed some politicians allied with former President Uhuru Kenyatta and his 2022 election main challenger, Raila Odinga, to the office.
Tulianza tukiwa pande tofauti tofauti. Saa hizi tunafunga mwaka.
We started as divided people and are closing the year with a broad-based government. We have brought many Kenyans together, Ruto says. Political observers say this move is designed to better manage the opposition to his administration. Martin Andati, a political analyst, says such political maneuvers will do little to ease the public's anger toward the Ruto administration.
The guys in power are behaving like nothing happened. But the truth is the dynamics completely shifted. But you know, the old class, political class, inclusive of President William Ruto, Raila Odinga, the likes of Kalonzo, they are still stuck in a time warp. They are still thinking along tribal chieftains and political kingpins. Then they are going back to 2007, when these youth are in 2027 already.
Political observers predict a tough political fight ahead, as the Kenyan government and political parties have to constitute a new electoral commission. The current one technically exists, but all the commissioners' terms have expired. Some are concerned that youthful activists will start petitions to recall members of parliament, a move that, if successful, may lead to the fall of the government and an early election before 2027. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally today, women taking part in a motorcycle driving class in Pakistan's eastern city of Lahore are hoping to become more independent. The Women on Wheels, or WOW, program has been offered for free by local police since 2017, but has recently grown in popularity as car prices have soared. Alice Rizzo of Reuters has our story.
A group of Pakistani women listen intently as an instructor gathers them around a motorcycle. They are taking part in the Women on Wheels, or WOW, motorcycle driving program and hope that learning how to get around on two wheels will offer them more independence. Among the students is Gania Raza, who is pursuing a doctorate in criminology.
It will help a lot in breaking the glass ceiling. We often talk about women's empowerment. I believe for me personally, bike riding is not just an activity or amusement. It's something that really empowers us.
Although the program has been going since 2017, a social activist told Reuters that it's rare to see women driving motorcycles in Pakistan due to cultural and religious taboos. WOW's popularity has also increased in recent months due to soaring car prices. The most affordable Chinese-made motorcycle costs about $410, while the cheapest car in Pakistan is about 20 times more expensive. The Women on Wheels driving program is offered free by the Lahore Traffic Police. It has so far trained at least 6,600 women, according to a traffic warden. Mother of three and part-time fashion designer Shumaila Shafiq took the course.
Learning to ride a motorbike has been a great convenience for me. Now, as the one in charge of the household, I can drop my children off at school. In this context, I feel it's valuable to learn this skill.
Laiba Rashid hopes that after the training, she won't have to rely on her brother to drive her to college anymore.
This program has brought positive changes in my family. My aunt heard about this program and she wants to join the next batch. My other sister has also learned about this. I'm the first girl in my family to learn this. Now, several women and girls in my neighborhood are saying they also want to learn this.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.